are listening to Tech Reads, interviews with emerging technology thought leaders. Our sponsor is Softech, the premier technology trade association that has been serving northern Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County since 1997. Our mission is to create Softech moments where people connect, explore ideas, and create new business opportunities. Learn more at softec.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Brian Schwartz from Tech Reads, the soft tech podcast that you have come to know and love. I think this is our 21st or 22nd episode. With me is Bob DeMuccio, our president, and we are fortunate to have Bill Kennedy. Is that how I say it?
That's exactly right.
Okay, on the phone with us from Florida. Bill is the author of The 80-20 CEO, Take Command of Your Business in 100 Days. He's actively out promoting it and talking about it. I know he's very prolific on the internet. So if you have more questions, well, one, I recommend you pick up a copy of his book. But two, you can also search and find no shortage of information that he's been so generous to share and kind of just talk about it. So maybe just in just about 2 minutes, Bill, for those of the folks that don't know who you are yet, give us a quick bio on what you're up to and what led you to publish this book.
Well, first, thank you so much, Brian and Bob, for having me on here. This is exciting. You guys have a wonderful platform, and I'm honored to be part of it. And say a little bit about myself. So I run two different private equity companies. They're middle market size. One's called OTC Industrial out of Columbus, Ohio, about $1 billion. And the other one's called Arrowhead Engineered Products out of Blaine, Minnesota, about $1.5 billion on that one. And in my spare time, I like to write books and have fun with that. So married, live down in Florida, as you said, and just blessed to be here. So thank you again for having me.
You bet. And so you are a little bit about your upbringing in the beginning. You did go into the service. You spent some time in the Navy.
I did. You know, it's funny. I tell this story all the time. So I grew up like many people, just dirt poor. So we were at the end of a dead end dirt road in a double wide trailer. And my ticket out of there was to join the Navy. And I went and did 3 years. And, you know, it was at the time. And it's funny, Brian, you and I were talking about this earlier. I wasn't so sure about it. You know, they give you a lot of orders. And looking back on it now, it was without a doubt the best time in my life. I learned so much, and it's a safety net, right? They feed you, they clothe you, they give you a place to stay. You just have to keep your nose clean and learn how to become, for me, a man, right? So it was such an honor to do it.
Well, and I mean, we look back on those times in our life where we had to overcome some adversity, and I suspect that you were put into some adversity that you had to learn to overcome. That, again, we don't really recognize the value of those things until much later in life when you face great adversity. So kind of what prepped you to step into the role of being a CEO and moving out of that kind of employee or novice mindset to having the ability to then start to lead people? And I'm always curious about that journey, because it's not like one day you just woke up and said, they're working for me now. I'm the captain of this ship. I mean, you had to build that up and build trust and build a team. I mean, it just didn't happen overnight.
Yeah, for sure. Right. It's took me 30 years to be an overnight success. Right. So, you know, it's interesting. Everything we've done, everything we've experienced has brought us right to this moment. So you change anything and maybe we're not sitting here. Right. Maybe we're sitting on our own island like Richard Branson, or I'd probably be shoveling ditches or something. So it's just accumulation of things. And as I look back on it, it's easy to say, well, it was really a straight line thing. As you said, I woke up one day and thought, wow, wouldn't that be cool? But, you know, to make a short story long, I got out of the Navy. I moved to Chicago, met the young lady who became my wife, and we started raising a family there. I did not have a degree. And wife, who was a school teacher, she got her degree and we started having kids. She was going to get her master's. I'm like, wait a minute, I can't let her get that far ahead of me. Right. And plus I felt like I had more in me than that. And, I was a sales guy. I had a big mouth and I wasn't afraid to get in front of people, things like that, but I wanted to come inside. You know, I wanted to come inside and for a whole variety of reasons. And I decided the key for me was I needed to get an MBA from the University of Chicago. I was like, that's going to be the key for me. The only thing I was missing was I didn't even have an undergrad. And so I had a friend of mine that had attended the University of Chicago, and he let me use his, it's funny, at the time they called it the Facebook. This was before Facebook as we know it. And so he let me use his login, and I went in the alumni directory, and I did a simple search around what was the local school, because I lived outside Chicago, that had sent the most people to Chicago. And it was Elmhurst at the time, Elmhurst College. And I applied there and got accepted, and then spent the next few years figuring out how to get in Chicago. And so it's interesting. So today I actually sat on Elmhurst's board. I'm the chairman of the investment committee. So it's funny how the loop closes through the years. But I went, I did that, got my degree, got both my degrees, got out. And that was really you have these big inflection points. So that was a big inflection point. And I went to work for this company called Invensys. And I learned something critical for me that really became super important was, in chaos, there is opportunity. And if you come out and you get a job in a company that's very, very stable, it's really hard to advance, right? But if you come out and you're willing to put in the effort and energy and you can deal with the ambiguity, going to work for a company that's in trouble, well, you can accelerate your career. And Invensys was in terrible trouble. I had no idea at the time, but they were in bad financial shape. They're a big old company, about $25 billion. They decided that they needed to sell themselves. I got involved in that. And I was just on the deal teams and things like that. So went through, sold that. And that led me to starting to working for companies and helping them, both I had the growth side and I knew how to sell the businesses. So I left from there, went to a company called Generac, was part of the group that got that ready to sell. Left from there, eventually wound up at a company called IDEX. And IDEX is where I learned to run companies. So I knew how to sell at this point. I knew how to sell them as well. And that's where I really learned my operating chops there. It was a wonderful organization. I got really grounded in what became known for me, at least, as 80-20 and some other pieces. That was my next big inflection point, right? And so from there, once I had that skill set and it became, I don't want to say easy, but it became clear what I could go do. I had set myself up really well to come in. I understood capital structures of companies. I had bought them, sold them at this point. And most importantly, I knew how to operate them. And that's really what put me on the path to where I am today.
Yeah, I suspect, being willing to step into a chaotic situation requires that you maintain your kind of calmness within that chaos. What strategies, what allowed you to sort of keep your cool when, the place was on fire?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it was just, I was too dumb to know it was on fire, right? I mean, I remember I graduated from University of Chicago and I thought I wanted to be an investment banker, right? And I did a little internship while I was in school and I got a job offer. And so they took us to New York, my wife and I, and we had these two little babies at the time. And I remember they offered me the job and my wife said, I hope you and your new family like New York because there is no way I'm moving to New York with these kids because the apartments are about the size of a postage stamp. Yeah, New York's wonderful, but they are not known for a Midwest gal who is used to a yard. So that was out, and I searched around and got the offer. I was really excited about it. It was a big global company, lots going on. It was a meaningful role. So I slid right in. I think like most of us, you go apply for a job and they don't really tell you everything. If it's maybe marriage is the same way. So they didn't really, and I get there and I'm like, holy cow, this thing is not doing well. It was a wonderful business. The issue was they had too much debt. They had done so many deals and the debt was killing them. And that was what was the thing. So the machine, I don't know, you could argue it was broken or not, but the capital structure was a mess. And that created opportunity. So if you're gonna do something and you wanna leap ahead, you gotta put yourself in a place, in a situation where you get that chance. And so there's things that come with it that that are kind of the natural mile markers, if you will. So first of all, guys like me, guys who get ahead doing this, you don't wind up in the really hot spots, right? You don't work in Chicago or New York. You work in Rockford, Illinois. You work in Cedar Falls, Iowa, right? All wonderful places, some of the greatest places, but, you know, not really even on the map of places. So you have to go to places that aren't, and you go to companies who will give you an opportunity because they need help, right? So that, in by the very definition, means something's not going right. When today, when I get a call and they say, "Hey, will you come be our CEO?" No one calls you to change CEOs if things are going great, right? Something's happening, and you need a process and a tool and a way to think about it. With my background at that point and the education I had and the things that I did, while I was not always correct, I was rarely uncertain. I knew exactly where I wanted to start and how to go with it. So yeah, it's that kind of thing, putting yourself out there, willingness to take a chance, willingness to make a bet on yourself, and then having that agile, that flexible mindset to get through it makes all the difference.
Bob had a good question about this 80-20 rule. Maybe you can tell a little bit about how you came up with even the title, which oftentimes is the title and cover, which, as you know, can predispose your reader to what they're getting themselves into. So maybe share a little bit about the 80-20 rule and how this has served you.
Yeah, 100%. So interesting enough, so of course I did not invent the 80-20 rule. That was Pareto. But it's one of those things, it's so correct, it's a truism, right? It's almost like a law of nature. Pareto studied pea pods and land in Italy. He was actually a French person, but he was brought up in Italy and noticed that 80% of anything came from 20% of whatever you were putting to it. So you take a piece of land, 20% of that land gave 80% of the yield. He looked at ownership of it. 20% of the families in Italy owned 80% of the land, and it went on and on and on. And it's been proven many times since then. And then from that, it really has become a way to look at things. And it's also intuitive, right? It's not everything works. You have to get focused around something. And if you look at your average company, they go through this cycle. So if the three of us today were to go start a business, we'd probably call it the three B's, right? B, 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 B for Bill, Bob, and Brian. And we'd have this really cool thing that we're going to go do.
B to the power of three.
B to the power of three.
It works perfect with your logo.
I tell you what, absolutely. So B to the power of three. And you know, we've got this wonderful skill set. We got all this background, but we need one key thing, and that's customers, right? And what you do when you start out, what do you do when you start out, when you start a new business? What's the key thing you do?
You got to go find out where the needs are so you can fill them.
That's right. And basically anyone who will pay any attention to you, you will take. It's like being a 16-year-old kid. It's all good, right? So,
right.
So
what
you
do
start
people want
out,
to pay you for, right?
That's right. Anything somebody will give you time, and sometimes not even what they don't even pay you, right? You want stuff. That's how you get going, right? People take a chance on, they take a chance on the 3B group, and we would do pretty well, and we would get more. And in a quickly amount of time, we would have a set of customers, because remember, we probably took some for free. We for sure gave that away. And then others we underpriced because we didn't know what to charge. But we'd have a couple that were paying the bills. But you know what we would quickly run out of? Time. We'd run out of time. There's only three of us. We can only handle so much. That's where you now have to decide, where are you really making money? We get together. We say, well, we got 100 of these. You know, 80 of them are useless. They demand everything. They drive us crazy. But these 20 are where it's at. That's where you start exiting or treating those 80 different than those 20, because 20 are paying the bills. And you have to. If you don't do that, what's your option?
Well, you just try to do more with less, but your quality suffers. You spread yourself too thin, and then you lose one of your 20% of your clients. And then you're like, oh, crap.
Absolutely.
The bill.
You're either going to put more costs in the business because you got to have, we got to go from 3B to 4B to 5B. And guess what? The other two Bs want to get paid. Since we're founders, we're not even taking a paycheck. But those guys, we have, they're for sure going to want money. So now we're even thinner and you got all these demanding and you can't, some of you are not very good at, obviously, otherwise you'd be making more money. You're going to have to get yourself aligned around where it's at. The whole 80-20 principle is nothing but data. We could, in a matter of minutes, particularly if you only got a handful of customers, say, I'm making money here and I'm not making money there. I'm making money with these products. It turns out certain customers like certain products and we're better at certain things than others. We may be really good at podcasting to them. We may not be so good at doing their windows or something like that. And so we'll look at what the services we're selling to the companies that we're selling to and try to pick the best companies with those best services. And then either charge differently, exit the service, whatever. There's a million different things you can do. In fact, we have this ratio called Earn the Right to Grow that has 12 steps of what you go through on it. But then we would have to figure out how to get ourselves out of that so we could go do it. That's the whole secret of the book. And so when I run these companies, I don't care how big they are, I don't have to figure everything out. So this is one of my greatest learning was Lean. Are you both familiar with Lean?
Sure.
Right. You know, and it's all about just getting the waste out, right? So you can have a factory. You got two factories. Both of them are underperforming for a variety of reasons. If you can understand where you're making money and who you're making it with, don't go fix the factory that is with the products you don't make a lot of money with. Shut that factory down. Exit it. Go fix the factory where all your money's being made. And so I learned a long time ago, I'm a huge Lean fan, but you can throw $1 million at a product that's worth a nickel. I say, don't fix that product, get out of it. The data will tell you which one it is. You should take that $1 million and go put it into a factory, a product, customers who like us, will pay us and like our services. Go fix those things. That's what Lean does, or excuse me, that's what 80-20 does. It identifies where the opportunities are. You do it in your life. You do it in your businesses. You do it in anything. I will bet you, I'm looking at you, Bob. I bet you that you, I like that t-shirt, right? You like that t-shirt? Yeah. What does it say on it? What does it say?
On the back of it, it says, I didn't go to Harvard. I went to Vietnam.
There you go. I'm going to suggest you probably wear that shirt a lot, do you?
Once in a while.
Once in a while. I'll bet you do because I do the same type of stuff and my wife, they get kind of hooked. You look in your closet, you might have 100 shirts. I'll bet you there's 4 or 5 just like that that you like and the rest of them you never wear. You could throw away all those other ones. You wouldn't even miss them.
You are correct.
You can run your life. You can absolutely run your life on 80-20. Identify what's important. You don't have to guess. The data will tell you. You know, Brian, you've seen Bob show up in these shirts 100 times. You know exactly what he likes, right? The rest of
He's
them
got some fancy ones. He's got some fancy ones too, but I don't see them as often.
Well, no, of course not. Cause every once in a while, you know, we got to go to a funeral or a wedding. You got to have something, but the majority of the time it's just like this guy. So you identify that. And that's a really good point. So sometimes you do keep other ones around, but honestly, you can get rid of those and it's not going to materially change anything. It's the same way with this. The biggest issue you have when you start living your life this way, when you start running your business this way, is it's not your customers, right? Who do you think fights you the most on it?
Your employees?
Your employees 100% of the time because it means change for them. I'll pick on a salesperson primarily because I came out of sales. I know even though this customer is not great, he's my customer. He pays me. I'm making a little bit of money. Now you're telling me I'm going to have to raise prices. I'm going to have to do something. There is a probability or certainly a possibility I'm going to lose that customer. So they will internalize it and see it as a loss for them. That's your biggest challenge is you have to help your team do the transition. They have to be part of where it's going so that they can see that not only is this good for the company, it's good for them as well.
It's like taking the medicine, the hard medicine. And before you go any further, before I forget, so Bob was my mentor for a few years, and he taught me that businesses don't die because of a scarcity of opportunities. They die because of an abundance of opportunities. And they're violating that 80-20 principle because they're trying to chase all these different opportunities, and they wind up missing the ones that were actually probably going to make them successful. And I think that's more true today than ever before.
Ever before. It is so true. We have an abundance of information. I mean, I am inundated with information. I have more opportunities than I can say grace over. I'll take over a company. I'll go in. I'll help someone. Without question, it's not the dearth. It's just the opposite. They have 1,000 initiatives, and they feel compelled on them all. Their team, and you know what it is? Because a strategy, at the end of the day, is nothing more than giving up something. It's saying no to something, right? You say yes to if everything's bold, nothing's bold, right? So as the leader, and this is the hardest part, not everyone can do this, you have to tell people no. And those people, you have to be able to deal with in such a way that they don't, it's not about them, right? As a human being, you want to help everyone, right? You want to do the best you can. You want to give the best insurance, the best vacation. You want to let everybody work from home and pay them $1 million a year. I mean, it's all true. As the CEO, the leader of the organization, you have to take and turn a profit big enough to support all this stuff that we're going, right? You have to, as you said, right? You have to make this work. The way that it works for us is we have to weave our way through that. You can't be all left or all right. There's this, sometimes you got to, you know, you'll have that, you'll be doing the data, it'll come back, and it'll clearly say that this area we're not making any money. And you'll have an employee, they'll raise their hand and go, no, you don't understand. This is so important. As the leader, you need to listen to that because, you know, the data is just the data. It doesn't tell you what your strategy should be. It's just the data. You have to listen to that. And maybe you say something like, you know what? Let's take and give it a window. Let's give it 30 days, 60 days, 6 months, whatever it is. Let's put some milestones around. If it hits it, it got across. If it doesn't, then it's out, right? Or you can just say no, or you can just say yes, right? But you have to, as a human being, find a way to navigate yourself, your organization, your team, your investors through all of that, because everyone, what they're going to hear is, I'm losing something. They're not hearing what they're gaining. They're hearing I'm losing something.
Bill, I have a question about the 80-20 application. And I read your book. Oh, I didn't read it. I listened to it. So it's my drive time, gym time kind of book. And the question that I have is that when you go into a business, and first off, I agree with the 80-20 rule. And I think you and I may have crossed paths actually at Generac. They were one of my clients in Wisconsin for when I did software development on IBM platforms. But the question I have is that when you apply the 80-20 rule and you go through that process and you drop that 80%, now obviously that's a simple expression of it. It's more complicated than that. What do you do next? Because
that is
you can't keep applying the same principle over and over, or you will save yourself out of business and you will get yourself down to one customer in two iterations.
For sure. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I haven't said this through 80-20, but for Lean, I always did say this. The goal is to get it down to one customer made in a factory the size of a postage stamp with one product. I sell it once a year, right? Because we just kept leaning it all out. And but you're 100% right. People can't... 80-20 is not a asset reduction or an employee reduction program. In fact, neither is Lean, right? But it's easy to fall into that. So you have to take the journey together. And as a leader, the way you make sure you get buy-in is you set the goal. And typically the goal is quantitative. And it's some number like, hey, I want to make 100, whatever 100%, right? And you sit down with your team and you show that the 100 is reasonable, like it's some type of normalized growth rate. We have the capital structure, whatever it is for. Their goal, their job is to develop the strategy to get you there. How did I make that little thing go up? Look at that. You just see a thumb go up? Look, even Zoom is agreeing with me. So that's powerful, right? So look, there you go. Who knew? So you immediately have to get it from your plate to their plate. That's key. They got to own it because they've got to execute. If you tell them what the strategy is, you're cooked, right? Because they're going to come back and say, you know what, Bob, I never believed it anyway, and you made me go do it. No wonder it failed. So that's first. The second thing that you do is once you get into it, you'll go through this process of where you have all the data in front of you, the team has it in front of them, and now they got to start making some decisions. And the way the decisions are made is actually quite simple. So you don't so much think about what I'm getting rid of or what I'm going to go do at the beginning. You just put them in the bucket and you say, given what I have, what is it I want to do? So first is one of the underlying principles is your profitability will primarily be in your quad one, which is made up of your best customers and your best products. And typically that's going to represent about 200% of your profit. And the key thing in that is to recognize it's 200%, and none of us have 200% profit, right? We only have 100%. So over the next three quadrants, we give that money away to get ourselves down to 100%, with the majority of it being given away in quad four. So now you go over to quad four, and here's a couple of the things to keep in mind. While your profit lies in different buckets of the four, your costs are typically even spread across them all. So each bucket is going to have 25%, right? So you get the quad four. Quad four typically represents around 4%, 2 to 5% of the overall profitability, just because there's not many sales in it. It's just the sense there's not many sales. So you got $100 million of profit. I like using 100 because the math becomes easy to me, right? You got 4% coming into your quad four piece, right? Now you look at your sales out there, and let's just say for the sake of argument, you have $100 million of cost too. You're going to have 25% in each bucket, 25%. That's the way it works out every time. So quad one's got 25 million, quad two's got 25 million, and so on. So in quad four, you got 4% of your money sitting there, which is $4 million, and it's being supported by $25 million in costs, right? And that's where the aha comes in. You go, oh my gosh, so it does, if they double profitability, and they'll be so proud of it. Well, the cost doesn't change. It's still $25 million, and you've worked your tail off to go from 4 to 8. So now instead of losing $21 million, you're only losing $16 million or $17 million. Still pretty bad. So what do, right? We identify the amount of resources that we need to solve or serve quad four. And we have a list of things that you say that we'll do. Like we look at minimum order quantities. We say we want you to place the order only online or whatever, right? There's all these things. So you really try to push them a little bit more to self-serve is what you're doing. You make it a little harder to do. It's just like if you don't, do either one of you fly very much?
Yeah, I just got back from a trip.
Yeah, so if you fly a lot and you're a premier type member, whatever they call it, you're a global services, you're a diamond member, whatever, you get a special line to call and you get a special app and all this other stuff. If you're not, you just call it like everyone else calls, right? So you still have a way to get to the customer has a way to get to, but they don't get the special treatment here. And if you've flown, and you'll know what I'm talking about, as far as they get early boarding, they get places for their luggage. So you still have the capability of taking care of the customer, but you take all those resources that you can, and you move those from that quad four to quad one. Now, why is this important? Quad one's where all the money's at. And for sure, you don't have all their business. It's a rare thing to say I have 100% of my customers' business. You identify where it's at. So you got 25% in quad four. In my experience, you can only get about half of it out. So about 12.5% is what you wind up getting out. You can do more. It just takes a long time because it's generally systems that you got to change. It takes a while to change systems, new ERPs, new websites, all that. You free up the 12.5%. Your team that runs quad one will tell you what their growth plans are. They'll say, well, I've got 30 customers in here out of my 100. These are the ones I really like. I'm going to surround you. You go, okay, I'm going to take my sales people, which may or may not be the right people. I'm going to make them available, or at least a headcount available to you. How many do you need? It's rare they need all of it. But they take what they need. They take the research, what they need. The rest of it, you will either help them go do something else or you'll redeploy them to somewhere else off of it. That's how you do it. So you're not trying to cut, because you cannot cut your way to glory. You're trying to put your resources where there's an opportunity for them to actually make money.
Bill, the other question I had is that, and this is actually kind of a snide remark, so don't take it too badly.
I've been married a long time. You can't hurt me.
You know, it's the 80-20 CEO, but you spend most of the book talking about four quadrants, which is 25%.
Yes.
And I just found it odd in going through the detail of the book. But I agree with almost all of the stuff you say. The only thing is, I run the CEO roundtables for the region, so I regularly communicate with about 60 other CEOs.
Sure.
And what strikes me is that in all of those discussions over the last 20 years, never have I heard a CEO get a question that had an 80-20 answer to it. It's always 51-49. And it's in it. And if it was an 80-20, someone else below that CEO role would have grabbed that problem, solved it, taken a bow, and got the credit for it. And CEOs never get the easy question. So it's just a comment about the 80-20 CEO. I think maybe the 80-20 manager is a better process for it, because I think you do see these types of problems, obviously. And the 80-20 rule, I've seen that all through my career. But those rarely get to the higher level unless it's on fire. And in private equity, I can see that could be common.
Well, I don't know if private equity is more on fire than anyone else. I think everyone gets their turn in the barrel from time to time, right? So the only difference between so let me take these one at a time. I'll finish answering this first. Okay. There's two types of companies out there. There's mission-driven and values-driven. So a values-driven company, they have a greater purpose they're existing for than necessarily just what the business. A lot of time you see that in a private company. It's the values of the owner. It could be taking care of the employees, the community. And it could be they just want a bigger boat, right? Whatever the values are. Typically, the primary value is the dividend that their family's living off of. They want to make sure that's taken care of. There's nothing good or bad about it, but it's just values driven. A mission driven company is a company that is on a mission to accomplish something specific. You typically find that in private equity. They typically are looking for 3 times their equity investment back out of the company in a certain amount of time, say 5 to 7 years, whatever it is. Every company is a little bit different. The metric, it can be different. It is far easier to run a mission-driven than it is a values-driven, because when you have mission, everyone's on the same thing. Our goal is to get $3 back for every dollar that went in, which does not mean you can cut your way there. It's just the opposite. You just know exactly what you're where you're trying to go and when you're trying to get there by. It's like saying, today, we're all going to go to Chicago. If I said that and you all got to be there by Wednesday, you could figure out how to get there. However, I said, we want to make humanity better. It's a little more difficult sometimes, right? We're not exactly sure. A public company is typically a combination of both mission and values. That's why it makes it so hard to drive. On one hand, every 90 days you report your earnings. That's the mission. My goal is to grow that earnings per share. Very straightforward. I also have every special interest group in the world, because anyone can own the stock. And so the values get a little convoluted. It's very difficult to be a public company CEO, because it just depends on where we are in the reporting cycle to sometimes to where it can be. So mission and values driven. Second thing you said was about what makes the CEO's desk. The only thing that makes my desk is the stuff that was the hardest things to answer, where there's no clear cut answer. It is just firmly in the middle of the gray. All the fun and cool stuff, just like you talked about, Bob, has been made by someone else. I never get asked where we're having our Christmas party, or do people get a turkey, or how many vacation days. No one cares. They just, it's like, up. It's just people love celebrating, you know, holidays and decorating and having a costume thing. The stuff that comes to me is the stuff that nobody wants to make, and there's no obvious answer. And a lot of times those are also very charged issues, right? It could be bet the companies. It could be all sorts of things that we got to do. That makes my desk. That's, you're exactly right. Now, why should 80-20 be on the CEO's desk? depending on where you are in your journey with your company, right? It takes three people to run a company and for sure to change the direction of the company. The first one is the CEO. We call that person a visionary. They tell you, this is where we're going. They pick the goal. Think of them as the general in an army. I always like, Bob, you and I are ex-military guys. It's easy for me to understand how military works, right? So you've got the general, and the general says, we're taking that hill. We're going to go take that hill. Why we're taking it, not everyone has to know or understand. It's helpful if they understand the why, but that decision typically rests at the very top. How you get to go take that hill, as long as you're within the normal and customary standards of whatever the culture and the tool capabilities are, that's for the folks on the ground to decide, right? You'll put together your plan. And Bob, do you remember what Eisenhower said about plans?
They never survive first contact.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The plans are useless because everyone gets a vote. The enemy gets a vote. The soldiers on and on. But the art of planning is absolutely necessary. So that's why you need your strategy. So this, what you're going to do, I promise you, it will not be what you drew up when you were in your nice conference room. But it gives you where you're starting, you know where you're going, and you've probably got some contingencies in. So the CEO, the visionary, sets the goal. This is where we're going. The operators, the folks in the middle of the companies, the senior leadership team, the managers, the directors, everything else, they develop the strategy. That's typically the folks on the CEO staff develop the strategy. Their teams go execute the strategy, right? They're the ones out in the field making it happen with all the necessary tools. So we want to win. That's how we know our tool capability, right? If you're in the military, fire your gun, know how to use your shovel, be a medic. And we want to win, right? That's our culture, right? That's why in the Army, the Navy, Marines, you have all these things with culture. So when you're a 21-year-old lieutenant and you got your six or seven guys with you, you're out there. Not only do you know how to shoot your rifle, you know when to shoot your right rifle, hopefully so. And then the final piece you need is you need trainers. You need someone who is an expert on whatever the process is you're going to go deploy, because for sure your team's not, right? The goal is those people have to come inside your company really quickly. You want them to not give you a fish, but teach you how to fish, right? We call those in our process the prophets, right? Because they got the roadmap to get you there, and we're looking for profits. So it's a little bit of play on words with it. So you got your visionary, you got your operators, and you got your profit. If you're going to change this company, if you're going to take a company that is not doing well, or conversely, you believe can do better, doesn't have to be a turnaround. The only person who can make that happen is the CEO. The CEO must make it a condition of employee to do things differently. If not, people will keep doing exactly what they've been doing. It starts with the CEO. Then the operators have to, one, understand the process and follow the process and go execute on the process. And you've got to have someone to train you how to go do it. Without that, no one, even though it makes the most sense in the world to focus on the critical few, they just won't do it. Right? Because the business already has a lot of momentum in it. It's already doing what it does. And it's being successful enough that people are still getting paid, at least for some amount of time. So that's why it has to come from the senior leaders and those three individuals if you're going to put something like this in. Did I answer them all?
You did. And you created, of course, three more questions.
I hope so. That's exactly the goal.
But it seems to me that if you apply the 80-20 rule and your strategy is to remove that bottom quadrant, which makes perfect sense, you have to have a secondary strategy that feeds in new stuff to the buckets, because you never know what's going to drop. You didn't deliberately pick, nobody in their right mind picked something in the fourth quadrant. It got there because someone screwed up. For some reason, the world changed, the market changed, September 11th happened, and whatever. But it's interesting that I see organizations all the time where people try to save it, cut it, you know, go through that process, but they never think about the fact that you have to replace it too. So you have to go out and have the strategy for developing that inbound stuff, feeding that top quadrant, and that way you can go through this every X number of years, because it takes a while for that to happen.
That is so well said. You should, Bob, you should be my straight guy, right? So this is exactly right. So here's how the process works. So the CEO picks a goal. We're going to become 100. We're going to be $100 million profitable company. Today, we're at 50. And he sets down, or the CEO, the person sets down with their team, and the team believes it's possible. That's the key. They need to believe. Or if they don't believe, maybe it's the wrong team, or maybe you got a wrong goal, but you got to get through that so that everyone can then decide how they're going to get there. So step two is, what is the strategy that will go get you 50 more million in profitability? What's the strategy? And we know for sure you cannot cut your way to glory, right? There's no, don't worry. There is some cutting that needs to be done. What that is, who knows? The numbers will tell you. But ultimately, you must grow the business. And if you look at the typical business cycle and you look at what you can actually do, there's three phases that you go through, right? The first phase, so today, we got the three B's, right? And we've got our company, and we just got it, and things are going well, but, you know, we want to do better. What's the number one thing you can do to increase your profitability? What's the
quick? Go talk to your customers.
Okay, good one. What else?
Well, we got to look and see where the profit's coming from. So you're collecting data. No?
Yep. Let me make it easy. You can raise prices. Raising prices is the one thing you can do that will flow right to the bottom line. There's no friction on it. I don't have to hire people. I just take a number and I raise it, right? Now, most of the time in a business, an ongoing business, you know where you're really losing money. You know where you're really making. You may not know exactly, but we typically know the extremes to some degree, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we come in, we kick off three things right away. We kick off, let's get the data, right? We kick off the 100-day process, which is let's pick a goal and a strategy and so on. The third thing we do is let's fix obvious problems. Like, I've never been in a business that I didn't walk around and talk to 10 people to go, man, that's killing us. We have to stop this right away, or we got to go do this. There's always something. And generally, it's right. Now, you don't want to bet the farm. You don't do something so crazy, right? But you got this one, I'm not making a lot of money. If I just stop it, I might start making money, right? So as a CEO, the first thing you're looking for is opportunities to raise price. Don't be crazy, right? Because you can get the price in the short run and run everyone off. But there's generally some area that you can raise prices. And if nothing else, go raise the ones that you're not making any money on. Instead of raising your best customer prices, at least go raise some on that. That will hit your P&L first, not day one, but in theory it could be. But within 6 months, you can generally add about 100 basis points to your profitability by just getting some price through the door. What's the second thing that you can do?
Cut costs.
Cut costs. You're exactly right. That is, we call that productivity. And there's two or three different ones, but generally we're looking for some type of productivity around like buy things less, quit buying those things, right? You have, you know, a building I'm not using. I need to get out of the lease. Hey, we're renting cars. We don't have a deal cut with National. We're paying $100 a day. I can get that down to 40 a day. I don't have an agreement with FedEx or UPS or all that stuff. You can do that stuff almost instantly, right? It takes a little while to go through it, right? Generally, your first 6 months, you can get price. From 6 months to 18 months, you can start having productivity savings, which is really cost out. And it's on things that you're saving money. Yes, sir?
Well, I think I would put going out and creating the revenue enhancements well before the cost cutting.
And you can't get to them fast enough. Huh? You have to start all three at the same time, but you have to go to a customer and convince them to buy whatever it is you're selling. You can tomorrow decide to turn off a light. You have to go convince human beings to do what you want. Now, you start all three at the same time, right? You start your pricing, your productivity, and your growth at the same time. I'm just telling you when you can expect them to hit, right? So productivity, 6 months to 18 months, you start seeing that come in. Your last one's your growth. Growth, you typically see hitting 12 months to 2 years. Sometimes you got to develop new products. Sometimes you got to win a customer. Remember, there's no customer out there who's being ignored. If they're a B customer for you, they're probably someone else's A customer. You got to go win that customer. And if you cut prices to do it, you're in worse shape. The best place to go is to find your best customers, because we know they like us because they buy from us and they keep paying their bills and we know them. So we have an entree right in. Go in and find out what else you can be selling to them. So as we're doing these three, I'm just done it lots of times. Pricing you can get within 6 months, procurement around about a year, some really fast. And one of my companies, we redid our FedEx contract, $17 million, right? As soon as we signed it, you still got to ship the stuff to get the $17 million in savings, right? So that's a, so, but it took us 8 months to get the contract negotiated, right? So, and then growth is the longest one, because you have to either convince them to come with you, you have to develop the product they want, but sometimes you get luckier, and we all get lucky in some and we get unlucky in others. So, but that's the meat of it. Those are your three as you're leading it. So you start those right away. You start getting the data right away, because at the beginning, you're not going to make really bold decisions unless your house is on fire or your boat's sinking, right? You're going to make small decisions, beta decisions. You want big bets, kind of place one chip at the time. But as you get the data, you start knowing where you can make a big bet, because your risk is nothing. If I upset all my quad four, if I upset every one of them, at most, I lose 4% of my revenue and I exit 25% of my total cost. That's if I blow it up. I get quad one wrong, I'm out of business the moment I get it wrong. I'm done. Make sense?
It's interesting. Warren Buffett and you absolutely agree on the raising prices, which is his strategy with See's Candy, is he always wanted control of the pricing.
He's right. And he's done really well with C's, and I like their candies. Yeah. So he's done pretty good with Diet Coke, and he's a bright guy. But yeah, pricing is where you start. You sometimes can get more or less, but you have to start there, because it's the quickest one to get through your P&L, and you need resources, because the way you're going to grow the business is you have to invest in the business, and that money must come from somewhere. And investors and shareholders and stuff, they don't want to give you more money. They've given you all the money they want. They want a return on their investment. That means you have to self-generate it. And the only place, it goes back to your final question you had, why so much on quad four? Because that's where the resources are that you're going to deploy in the quad one. That's where they come from.
Good stuff. I'd love to move over to this new segment I'm starting as part of these podcasts, and it's called Behind the Curtain. So, for sure. Bill, you've been working hard to get this book out there. You've been very prolific and very available and investing lots of time and energy, especially as someone who's a proponent of the 80-20 rule. And you're learning kind of the 80-20 in action as a business coach, as an author, as a speaker. Love for you to share a little bit about the process that you've gone through. And I'm always impressed when someone who's as busy as you are can actually get a book done. But maybe just share us a little bit behind for people who kind of look in awe at someone who's managed to, I mean, build a platform in a relatively short period of time. I know you're kind of on your way up, working on getting more speaking engagements, but just a little bit more about sort of the business of being an expert and ultimately what you're aiming to get, or what you've been realizing as a result of promoting yourself and your book, and using the book, honestly, to get interviews like this has made all the difference in the world. But would love for you to just chat a little bit about your own kind of personal experience with this new world that you're in.
Yeah, great question. Bob, do you want to add something to that? Like you were...
No, I'm listening right now.
You were listening with bated breath. Yeah, so, you know, guys like me, we make it look easy sometimes. You know, as I said, it's not easy at all. It's not easy for anyone. And so when you're sitting on the outside looking in, it seems, wow, he just flipped some switch or whatever. You know, I'll give you a quick little story. I needed a website. And in my career, I know I'm exaggerating, but I have for sure have signed off on 1,000 websites. Got to be more than that. I think right now I have 200 or 300 websites, right? I mean, it's just you, all these little companies, you have them, right? No, I need to do one for myself. I had never actually personally done a website at all. I had, we need a website, go do a website. So I hired this company, and it's this little nothing because I'm paying for it myself, right? And I pay him $5,000, and I hire him in October. This goes back a couple of years, and month after month goes by, and it's horrible. I mean, it's just hard. I cannot get him to do what I want him to do. And I don't know why. It's like I'm speaking in Greek and they're listening in Hindu or what. And they're the nicest people ever. My wife, we have a grandson, and he had just been born. So our grandson's about a year and a half old. And she's going to go out of town to go see my daughter. And so as I always do, I have a problem. I like to work, right? But she, keeps me on even keel. So marry well. This is my best advice for all of us. Marry well, someone who will put up with you and still be nice to you. So she goes out of town, and I she's gone for a week. I just sit at my desk and drink Diet Mountain Dews and eat sugar, and I build that website myself, the whole thing, right? And it was the most mediocre thing I had ever done in my life, but it worked. It finally worked, right? And I learned so much. I would not recommend anyone go and do this, but this is kind of what you have to do sometime, right? You get somewhere and it's not working and you have to find a way, and you can't go around it or under it or over it. You got to go through it. And I didn't have the language. Now, if I was doing another one now, I would be so much better at it. In fact, I have found myself being so much better because I actually have done it and understand it. With it. Well, that's the whole journey with everything, right? You come up with your plan, and we can talk about how you come up with that. And then you have to find a path through it. It goes back to Bob, what you and I were talking about. The plan itself means nothing, right? But if you know what you want to accomplish, if you know what the end result is, you'll find a way. You just have to be prepared to fully engage. You go out and you talk to someone and this worked here and this didn't work there. I would say I'm my own 80-20 rule. 80% of what I've done over the last couple of years, completely wasted. Completely wasted, right? I mean, I can't believe I wasted so much time and effort and money and all that. But man, do I have this great set of knowledge now, and I'm getting better every day. And in fact, I'm going to launch my next book here, hopefully at the beginning of next year, right? So once you get it, the second piece I would tell you is no one, and particularly myself, you don't do any of this stuff alone. It takes an army of people around you to go do it, right? And what you find is there's people out there who are taking a similar journey. You need to find those. They're going to want to join with you, right? We're all three of us here together, and we're here honestly because it benefits ourselves. Like I want to help you guys, but I'm like you said, hey, I need to get the name out there. And then you guys need to have people come on your podcast. Now, you probably chose really poorly with me, but you'll have to work that out for yourself.
Blame Bob.
But, Bob, I loved it. He was on it. But anyway, but we do these 80, 90% of the ones I do, I go back and look and there's no one's watched them, right? Or it's de minimis. But sometimes they take off and it becomes, but if you keep your end result in mind, pick it, and then just ask you, all right, now given where I am, what's my next step, right? And then you try it. It takes an extraordinary amount of work. Most of it, you look at God, that was a waste of time. But if you have an abundance mindset and you really want to do this, you're not doing it for anyone else, just doing it for yourself. And, if it comes of nothing, then it comes of nothing. But I'm enjoying it. I'm getting a ton out of it. It's made me a better person, a better leader. It's really got the message out there more. The things I thought I would get, which maybe was just primarily ego satisfaction and things like that, what I've really gotten is deeper connections out there, and I've met so many people, and it's for sure enriched everything I've done in ways I'd never imagined.
I love that. And I would just comment that the 80-20 rule, that exactly what you're going through, part of the reason you hire a consultant, especially if they've been referred to you, is they know what that 20% is. And that's usually what I tell a client when they contact me, because they're like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do because I know that I can't do it all. And you've been doing this for 10, 15 years. You know what the 20% of the things are that are effective, at least in the genre niche, as long as they're qualified to sort of speak to it. It's a different, if you're a fiction author, you know, you'd want to talk to somebody who really understands the fiction world. But I think that's the usually the argument I use is like, you can go figure all this out on your own, but you're going to spend a lot of time doing it. And I said, do you have more time or have more money? Because if you have more time, then you need to go do the 80-20 work. But if you have the money and less time, it makes a lot more sense to find someone or pay a consultant.
I have one more question.
Please.
We're getting kind of down on
running out.
But this goes to the revenue side of your 3 points. And I've been in marketing for a number of years. I came out of the technology world and into the marketing world. And my question is that when developing revenue in a business, it is my experience that it takes 20 or so processes or steps to go from where I am to thank you for the order. From hello to thank you for the order is a complex process. And I equate it to like playing basketball. Everybody counts who shot the hoop, but the other guys had to be there and do their things to do that. So if it takes 20 steps to go through that process, and you're looking at measuring only the end piece, how do you account for the other 19, I'm going to call them required steps? Other people, you know, they want to go from an impression on an ad to an order, and they want to skip everything in between. Unfortunately, the market is 100 times more powerful than they are, and they don't get their way. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you handle that series of data that's interdependent in order to reach that end objective. I want to find $50 million in new revenue, and I've got a market of 10,000 people. I've got to figure out how to find out what's the 20 and what's the 80.
Yeah. So would you say the three, are you talking about how you get the four, it's actually four, take a goal, a strategy, reorganize. Is that what you're talking about there?
Well, oftentimes people try to simplify the process and it's more complicated. They look at the end goal of what they want. I want the ball in the hoop. But the bottom line is that there was a whole process that set up that to happen.
For sure.
And so those intermediate steps are rarely, if ever, actually recorded or part of the data or part of the thinking and consideration. And so I see a lot of people that run an ad campaign. And as a marketing guy, I say, you know, the stupidest thing you can possibly do is do a one-time marketing campaign. If you can't do it for the long term, shut up and go home. You know, it's that kind of thing. So how do you account for that data in between hello and the order?
And well, I think sure that's a really good question.
Out necessary parts.
But I think there's two sides to the coin. So let me answer, if I could, if you'll bear with me a couple minutes. And I know we're running out of time here. So the first is, whatever it takes to get an order from the outside, it takes 20 years to make an oak tree. You're not going to short circuit that, right? It takes 18 years to become an 18-year-old. I don't care what you do to yourself or anyone around you. And so if you think from order to cash, right, as you lay that out, that's what it is. Now, that's the one side. That's a dealing with the market forces as we know them. They have to find you. They have to understand what you have. They have to get trust. I mean, all these steps that you have to go through before you get it. I don't know how you short circuit it, right? And I've never been able to short. You can become more efficient at it and things like that. But when you look internally, and if you look at a lean process where you map out a value stream mapping, if you're familiar with that term, right, you can lay out your process, because ultimately what gets companies in trouble is their process that they are to take it from that maybe first contact all the way to getting paid, right? The order to cash is so convoluted. It's such a mess. You can't even get this stuff through. A person places an order with you. It comes in your email box, takes you 4 days to find it. Once you get it, you send it over to the next person. They're on vacation 2 weeks later, and it goes on. And what should have taken 15 minutes, you just added 30 days of time in that took less than 20 minutes worth of it, right? So if you look internally, you absolutely have to do the work around that to simplify. Now, when it's just the three bills there, the three B's that we're doing, it's pretty easy. But now get yourself 100 employees, get yourself 1,000 or 10,000. Holy cow, do you get a lot of complexity. On the opposite side, looking at what the market is, you're going to have to deal with whatever the market says. And if that's credibility, so for me, I agree with you. If you're not willing to advertise for a year, then you've just wasted your time, right? Because we're dealing with what's called the law of large numbers. You know, there's so many sales in there, you just don't know when they are. And so you have to keep putting yourself out there until you get traction. So each month, I'm blessed. I sell a few more books than I sold the month before. And I'm starting to see it really kind of get what I call the flywheel effect. Is it's a good book. It has a lot of knowledge out there. There's a market for this and people are looking for it. And so if one person reads it, so Bob reads it, Bob tells Brian, now we're all three on here. Maybe you got your 2,000 people. Maybe there's 10%. Maybe there's 200. Maybe there's 1%, 20 or something that are going to be interested. But it kind of goes on and on and on with it. That's these kind of books. So that's the viral piece of it. But going back to it, I don't think you can shorten the process that the market demands for you to get the credibility and them to get comfortable for it. Your internal processes, you want to simplify that as much as possible. And typically, there's extraordinary complexity in there. It just doesn't add no value at all. Did I answer your question, Bob?
It did.
Well, and
to the degree that could be answered.
Well, I'll give it again.
From my perspective, I like it because it shows that there's still all these steps that have to take place. And if you're wasting your time with the clients who can't afford to pay you the same amount as the ones who pay you more, you're still doing the same amount of work. Who are you fooling?
Yeah, I buy a lot of companies. I've done, 9 in the last year or something like that. So the hardest one to buy is a sub-million-dollar earning company. You know, their lawyer is the guy who is their divorce lawyer. Their accountant is their tax accountant, right? And the lawyer's like, there's more there. You should stick to it. And the tax accountant is like, well, your ex is gone. And it goes on and on and on. And it's so, and then they're wrong about the earnings, right? And a lot of times they're just losing money. It takes, it is easier to buy a $1 billion company every day of the week. I mean, you need the money, don't get me wrong, than $1 million, right? Because people who are doing this stuff, you've done so, you kind of know what to expect. And if you're new at it, you don't. So remember what I said, you got to have a CEO who makes it a condition of employment. We're going to go through this. You got to have people in your company who are willing to go through it and follow the process. And you need an expert. You need to hire the appropriate expert. Some days those are accountants and lawyers. Some days it's trainers. Some days it's 80-20 experts. Know where you are in your journey and get prepared to go through it. You don't want to be a leader by bestseller, right? Hey, this is the latest thing. Let's go through it. Understand, are you happy where you are? Are you making less money and working harder? Are you unable to find time to go get the new customers because you're so busy taking care of things that, you know, no money. I have a business in Minnesota that sells a variety of things around pumping technology. Anyway, one of the guys in there, wonderful guy, his favorite type of customers are craft breweries, right? The average order is $2,500 and we make no money on it at all. Absolutely. You look at it as the worst, but because it is so intense on the amount of help. So we're like, you need to think differently about it. I don't know, charge more, do something else. He wound up leaving us, right? Went, started his own business to take care of it. We raised the prices, some stayed, some left, but we were able to take the resources and put it in areas that, because if you look in the Minnesota, Wisconsin area, big machining area, yeah. Very German culture, a lot of machine, a lot of things going to Harley and Kohler and Generac. So a lot of highly engineered stuff, right? He went out of business a year later because guess what? He couldn't make any money at it either, right? So sometimes you do the best you can and it turns out the job just isn't for them.
Yeah, sometimes it's the boring businesses that are the most successful, right?
I like boring businesses that send me checks all the time, right? And those are just, they're hideous. I love them little things. It's common sense from, you know, John Dillinger. Remember John Dillinger? They said, John, why did you rob banks? And do you remember what his answer was?
Because that's where the money's at.
That's where the money's at. Now, I don't know if that's a true story or not, but it's a great one. And I've heard it for all my whole life. Well, that's the same reason here. Why are you identifying these customers? Because that's where the money's at. Well, why are you going to quit doing the others? Because there's no money there. Now, you have to decide what your strategy is to go get more money, right? You have to decide that. The process will not tell you what your strategy is. And then you have to decide, where are you getting the resources? And you get it from the place you're not making any money.
Yeah, Bob taught me a long time ago, you're going for a lifestyle business or you're building a business, because they're very different animals. And if you're having fun what you're doing and, you know, you have the freedom and you wake up every day excited, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you actually want to build a business that you can sell someday, you have to focus on sometimes the less enjoyable aspects of your business. Last question, actually. So is there a lesson on the cover with the bee and the honey? Is this anything that your wife may be inspired?
Oh, I wish it was. So, when I first started out, the first book I started writing, which I have not published yet, was called The Art of Making Honey. I was doing a lot of research around, you know, and bees and human beings have so much in common, right? They survive best as a colony when they're together. They work together. Everyone has their job. They have to do the job with it. If a hive is damaged, they have 6 weeks to figure it out or the hive goes out of business, just like a company, right? Your company goes in trouble. You have a limited amount of time to do it. How do they solve it, right? They're mainly female, but they have whatever they need to have. So if they need more scouts, then they produce more scouts. If they need more workers, they produce more workers. So they'll produce scouts. The scouts go out, find the next hive. They come back, and believe it or not, they have a dance off. And the one that has the best dance, I'm swear to God, I'm not making this up. Then a larger group will go out, look at the new location, decide it's good, and they will move the entire hive to the new location, right? They save themselves. They can repair it. They do the work themselves. And then plus, they give everything back to their environment, their nature, right? So you have honey bees, honey ants, you have honey birds, honey badgers, bears. I mean, it goes on and on. It's an ecosystem that keeps the world going from, you know, producing not only honey and things like that, but just pollinating our flowers. So I just thought it was a great representation of who we are and maybe even our better self. And if you look at the very humble bumblebee, there's absolutely no reason it can even fly. So it kind of resonated with me, and that's how it got going.
I love it. All right. And if folks want to learn more about you and more about the book, where you recommend they go?
So you can write in my website. It's my name, BillCannady.com. You can also send me an email to Bill@BillCannady. I try to answer them all, and I'm really active on LinkedIn, which is where most business people are, and I'll respond. So happy to help in any way we can. It's been a pleasure to do this, and I've learned as much as I've probably helped anyone, probably learned more. And I just want to thank you both for having me on it. This is fantastic, and you know, you guys really got something special going on.
B to the power of three. I love it. And
there you go.
The bees and everything. So a lot to think about. But again, I recommend, it's a great read. Bob DeMuschel is a very experienced, many business seller, many times over. So for him to validate this book and endorse it says a lot. He's coming from a place of experience.
Bob, he's got a great t-shirt.
Yeah. Any final words?
None for me.
Thank you for listening to Tech Reads, sponsored by Softech. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and share it with your colleagues. If you have comments, questions, or want to suggest an author for a future episode, visit Softech at softec.org and click on the Tech Reads link.